on the Empire Podcast this week, we have new and selected interviews with Noah Baumbach, director of the Merriwood Stories Brackets, new and selected. Plus, Rebecca Ferguson from The X Factor comes in to talk about her new...
No.
Oh, the other one.
The other one.
From Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
Okay. Plus, Rebecca Ferguson from Mission Impossible pops in to talk about her new movie, The Snowman. All that and more on the movie podcast that is quite frankly annoyed because my favourite high street Asian food place is no longer doing their chili chicken udon noodles. And I'm furious. I don't know. What's the world coming to? It's to madness, if you ask me.
It's to madness.
It's you mad.
Are you done with that?
Yes. Oh, that's good.
Are you done?
That's very good.
Are you done?
That's very, very good. Anyway, hello pod, I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week I'm joined by one colleague of such lethal cunning. And it's all a little bit slapdash around here, which is why the intro was completely ad-libbed and a bit shambolic. And John Nugent, the quiet poddle, is with me. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Yes, I'm here.
Good, good, good. I'm glad because if you weren't here, oh my God.
It's just a lonely man shouting into the void.
It's pretty much not that far off what it is every week anyway. But yeah, if you weren't here, this would be an interesting podcast.
Yeah.
So, yes. Why are we? Was it just us?
Well, I don't know.
Where is everyone?
Well, Phil isn't at Empire anymore.
Who?
So, some guy used to come in and clean. Just wipe the desk down every night.
Yeah, Phil's left. Phil's gone. Nick's busy. Because we do have a magazine to get out. We do have a day job. Nick's busy.
James is
busy doing cool things. Helen's in Belgrade.
Right, okay.
That's all I know. I know why she's in Belgrade. I can't say what she's doing in case it's top secret, but it's, you know, it's a cool set visit that she's doing. Terry is on a train, I think, to Scotland. And I'm not entirely sure why.
Okay.
But it's cool, you know, it's fine. It's all
fine.
Good. Who else? Who else do we have in the podcast on a regular basis who's not around? Now, you're here. Johnny is in the office. He's busy. Dan Jolin, who's been filling in for Phil, isn't here either. Right, that's it. Roll call's done. And you and I are the only ones who answered the call.
We're the only ones who aren't important enough to spend an hour chatting about films.
That's pretty much it, really. That's it. So should we chat about films?
Let's chat about
should
films.
Should we do it?
Let's do it.
All right. Okay, so it's just you and I. And so this question came through this week from Carl from Wolves. I thought this would be a great question for the group if we had, say, three or four people in here. This would be fantastic.
Yeah.
And the question is, with Friday being Friday the 13th, oh, Christ, it is, isn't it?
Mm.
Today, when the podcast is out, is Friday the 13th. Just wondering in which order you would rank all the Friday the 13th films, and that's from Carl from Wolves via Twitter. That is our question, and I thought this would be a good one for the team to discuss. You know, I know not everyone is, like, massively into their horror films at Empire, but, John, this franchise has kind of passed you by, hasn't it?
Yes, it has a little bit. I've seen the first one. I've seen a couple of the other ones. I think I saw Jason Takes Manhattan when I was a teenager, but I've not seen all of them. Have you seen all of them?
Yes,
you've seen all of the Friday the
13th. I've seen all the Friday.
How many are we
movies?
Talking now? This is like 12.
Okay, well, you're talking. There are 10 official Friday the 13th movies. Then there is Freddy vs. Jason, which is, you know, that's kind of spin-off thing. And then there's the Friday the 13th remake, which came out a few years ago and is pretty terrible. And they've been still trying to remake Friday the 13th for a while. And, you know, it's a compelling-ish story. It's, you know, pretty straight-up slasher stuff in some cases. The first movie is very influential. I really have a soft spot for these movies. They provided a great foundation for me when I was growing up, watching them when I shouldn't have been watching them. And they're completely and utterly schlocky, and some of them are absolutely terrible. Most of them are terrible. But there are noteworthy instances in the franchise.
Which one would you say is the best, then?
Best overall? One for me is Friday the 13th Part 4.
Okay.
The final chapter. I shit you not, that's what it's called.
I know
that. It was then followed by six more films.
I like that Saw has fallen into that trap as well. Saw did the final chapter.
Yeah,
and now we're seeing Jigsaw. So, you know,
yes.
There'll be another 10 films out of that franchise as well.
Resident Evil just did that as well.
Yeah.
But that does seem to be the final chapter, at least for the time being, or at least with Mila Jovovich. So I would say Friday the 13th Part 4, the final chapter, is notable for a number of reasons. One, the makeup effects by Tom Savini, and he is one of the absolute masters of practical horror makeup. He is brilliant, and he came on and he really stepped up the series gory game. Two, a young Corey Feldman is in it as a character called Tommy, who for a while became the hero of the series, and that was kind of interesting as well, because the Friday the 13th movies don't really have a hero that runs all the way through them. They have a bad guy that runs all the way through, Jason Voorhees. Now, of course, he doesn't appear in the first movie. Well, he's not the principal bad guy in the first movie. That's his mum, Mrs. Voorhees. But he becomes, obviously, one of the great horror icons. Massive, unkillable, zombie-type guy walking around with an ice hockey mask, which he gets in Part 3, and then and a machete as well. And he goes around, and the whole idea with Jason is that he's unkillable. So Tommy comes into it in Part 4. Who else is in 4? Crispin Glover is in 4. He gets killed in an interesting way. Spoiler alert. I also have a soft spot for Friday the 13th, Part 6. Jason Lives. Jason wasn't really in Part 5. There was someone pretending to be Jason. But he came back properly as a maggoty zombie, unkillable zombie in Jason Lives in Part 6. And that's a lot of fun. And that has Tom Matthews playing Tommy Jarvis in that one as well. That's the last time we see Tommy, I think. I like the penultimate one. Jason Goes to Hell, the final Friday. Which has a bounty hunter trying to take down Jason as well. That's got a nice sense of its ridiculousness. And I like kind of the two old school ones I really, really like. I mean, the original is fine. It's okay. It's one of those horror movies that just now seems horribly dated and just seems a little bit schlocky. And was all about the kills. And, of course, has a young Kevin Bacon being impaled. And, you know, it's fine. But I quite like Friday the 13th Part 2, which is the first time we really see Jason. It's one of the first horror films I remember that has that storytelling technique whereby a survivor from the first film, and by the way, I'm spoiling the series here completely, a survivor from the first film gets bumped off in the first few minutes of the second film. Mm. And you're going, what? What was the point of the last film in that case? And that's been done in so many movies since. I won't spoil them for you either. But Friday the 13th Part 2 is quite fun. 3 is 3D one, that's okay. The ones that are terrible, 5, 7, 8, which is Jason Takes Manhattan. Hmm. Awful, although it does have a sequence where Jason punches a man's head clean off his shoulders. Am I selling this franchise to you, John?
Yeah.
I think I am.
Yeah.
And then the last one, I think, is the nadir of the franchise, which is Jason X, in which he goes to space and was given 4 stars in this magazine by the great Timothy Newman. And as a result, and this is... did I work for Empire then? I must have done. I took a whole bunch of friends to see it in London. Yeah, I must have done, because it was in London. On my birthday, going, guys, this will be great. Kim gave it 4 stars, and it was absolutely atrocious on a almost irredeemable level. But Kim and I are fine now. We're all good. You know.
Okay.
I want to pick him up and shake him for the money. That, you know, come on, Kim. I know you got it. I know you're good for it, Newman. Come on. But yeah,
any franchise that goes to space usually doesn't end well. I mean,
unless you start there, like Star Wars.
If you start in space, fine. If you're a ground-based franchise, like James Bond went to space and it didn't go well, Moonraker.
That's harsh on Moonraker.
I think that's fair on Moonraker. I think I'm being kind to it, frankly.
Don't forget, Moonraker only lives to space for the last 20 minutes or so.
Yeah, yeah, but the space laser battle is just... I shudder.
Yeah, it's not good. So what have you seen? What have you seen in Friday the 13th?
I've seen the original, and I've seen... This was a very long time ago. I saw half of Jason Takes Manhattan. And I started watching Freddy vs. Jason, and I gave up on it fairly quickly.
That's quite fun when I like that one. Why'd you give up on it?
I don't know. I can't remember, to be honest. It was too long ago. I enjoyed the tagline on some of the posters for Freddy vs. Jason was "Winner kills all." I thought that was quite good. I seem to remember, although I might be misremembering this, there was another one that said, whoever wins, we lose. Am I thinking?
That's Alien versus Predator.
That's Alien versus Predator. That's the other franchise mashup.
Yeah, that's a truly dreadful
film. That is absolutely abominable
by every
standard.
And the sequel is actually even worse. The sequel makes you nostalgic for Alien versus Predator. You go, okay, this is, you know, because at least it has a director in Paul W.S. Anderson who knows how to position a camera, but yeah.
He knows how to turn it on.
To turn it on and take the lens cap off. Yeah. It's kind of weird because Freddy vs. Jason kind of killed that franchise. There was a whole idea, and at one point there was conversations that Ash from Evil Dead was going to turn up and best them both at the end, because obviously he is the greatest horror movie character of all time. But it didn't happen. And it's a bit of a strange one. It's quite fun. It's got someone from Destiny's Child in it.
Kelly Rowland.
Kelly Rowland's in it.
That's right. Wow.
Kelly Rowland is in it, and she's really good in it. As far as, you know, horror movie goes, she's
okay.
Fun and likable. But yeah, they're short. They're 90 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
So watch them all this weekend.
They're 90 minutes long. That's your recommendation. They are feature length.
They've got some good kills in them, if that's your thing.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, good gore.
Got good music. Cha, 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 cha.
Yeah.
Not selling it?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Anyway, thanks to Carl from Wolves for that question. And if you want to have your question read out on the Empire podcast, you can do so via a number of methods. You can tweet us, like Carl did, presumably, from Wolves. So we're at Empire Magazine on Twitter, and you can use the hashtag Empire Podcast. You can Facebook us, where we're Empire Magazine, and you can email us as well, where we're podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, time now for our first guest this week, making another appearance on the podcast. Rebecca Ferguson was on the podcast recently for Despite the Falling Snow, but when we heard there was a chance to get her back in again, we jumped at it because she's fantastic. She is, of course, the Swedish actress who could be seen in Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, and Life, and movies like that, and not the Liverpudlian singer from The X Factor, who's equally good. And I keep saying it every time she comes up in this, but she should sing the Bond theme. God damn it.
Sure.
Amazing voice. Amazing
voice. Good shout.
So, yes, John went along to speak to Rebecca Ferguson this week because she has another movie out, and it's called The Snowman, based on the best-selling books by Jo Nesbø. It's starring Michael Fassbender as the Norwegian detective, Harry Hole. Or is it just Hole in the movie?
In the movie, it's just Hole, but I think the correct pronunciation in Norwegian is Hole.
Yeah, like John Arne Riise. Mm-hmm. Hole. Okay, brilliant. So here she is, Rebecca Ferguson, talking to John Nugent. Enjoy.
We are delighted to welcome to the Empire Podcast Rebecca Ferguson. How are you doing?
I am well. I'm excited.
So we are talking about The Snowman.
Yes.
And you play Katrine Bratt.
Yes, Katrine Bratt.
So she's a colleague of Harry Hole, mm-hmm. played by Michael Fassbender, a fellow detective. But she's quite a sort of complex character, I suppose you could say.
She is. I think, and there's also one of the reasons why I loved playing her. And I sat down with Thomas when we started discussing this film, because the book version is one and we're doing something quite different with the film, under guidance of Jo Nesbø himself. And it's about sort of the subtle changes in Katrine, where she transfers from Bergen to Oslo and she ends up in this small team with Harry Hole as a leading detective. This guy who she studies his case at school, and he turns out to just be quite miserable, battling his demons and alcoholism. And it's a very hard meeting for her, and sort of her illusions are kind of just erased. But we see this struggling kind of young girl, and she's quite fierce, and she's determined to prove herself. And then gradually, as the story develops, we realize that her reasons are quite sinister and rooted in something else. But it's just not giving away too much. There was interesting shifts in her.
Yeah, it's directed by Thomas Alfredson, who did Let the Right One In and Tinker Taylor.
He's such a cult figure for film in Sweden, and his family and his father, who sadly enough passed away recently. But yeah. I mean, for me, it's like saying, do you want to work with Hitchcock?
Yeah, right.
And people sometimes ask me about being starstruck. And I have to say, meeting Thomas was kind of a moment like that for
me.
Yes, I kind of wanted him to love me and then at the same time just kind of be myself. It was an interesting meeting.
Yeah. I mean, he is a fellow Swede. Did you ever like sort of
talking Swedish on set and someone else.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite rude. Yeah, it is quite rude, and then at the same time, it becomes quite domestic and homey, right, knowing that I can just whip into Swedish and ask him something about my character. Mm. And obviously not, we're grown-ups. I wouldn't be criticising someone behind their backs in Swedish to Thomas.
Have any like sneaky conversations about
Michael. No, I'd go, what the fuck is Michael doing? But in Swedish, I found your Michael. No, none of that.
No. I read somewhere that, obviously, you're as a Scandinavian, you're quite used to the cold, but... I think Thomas Alfredson said that 95% of the snow in this film is real. Did that present any challenges at all?
Not challenges. It becomes much more interesting to shoot in the environment that is real. Mm. And when you're walking, you're actually knee-deep in snow, and it's hard and it's cold. And I think it's sometimes quite hard. I remember in Life, we had to do a scene where Jake Gyllenhaal and myself, we were... on board the spacecraft and everything's just defaulted and it's freezing cold. Mm. But it actually wasn't, it was quite warm. So you have to start creating the shake inside, and it's a very hard acting moment, and you get quite stiff. But here, it was so natural.
It's all real.
You're actually all real. And then also what's lovely is it brings the team kind of close together, because when it's so cold, it doesn't matter who you are. There's no hierarchy on set.
Yeah.
Everyone gathers in the little hut.
Yeah.
There's hot chocolate. There is a big fire.
Yeah.
Someone snuggling up with a book in a corner.
Nice.
Yeah, it keeps everything quite small.
Yeah, I noticed, because it is very sort of bleak, it's Scandi noir, but it also made me kind of want to go to Norway in a strange way. Do you know what I mean? It's some very beautiful locations.
It's exquisite.
Yeah.
And I'm so happy because I have always wanted to go to Norway, and I'd wanted to go into the fjords and the priest chair. I don't know if you've seen images of it. People jump from it.
Yeah.
What's fun, I think, here, what Thomas and Dion Beebe, the photographer, does brilliantly is you have these incredible landscapes that look like Harry Potter world. I mean, it's magic.
Mm.
And there's an air of serenity and just calm, but flip it around, make it cold and brutal, and throw in, a serial killer who likes chopping people
sure.
up. It just becomes utterly terrifying and lonely and scary.
Yeah.
The same milieu can just flip.
Yeah, yeah. It's really interesting.
Mm.
And obviously, this being Scandi noir, you get to wear some fantastic knitwear as well.
Oh, God, how great are they? The big socks and the woolly jumpers and the hats and...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's my style.
Pretty comfortable. Did you have a favourite cardigan or jumper?
I think I have a blue jumper
outside
of a shirt. I always have these sort of stripy shirts, the flannel shirts.
Okay, yes, yeah.
Which are so good.
Yeah.
I had also reindeer shoes, but I think they're fake.
Okay.
But reindeer shoes that were green.
Wow, okay.
Which are just so warm and beautiful. And I think I got one of the knitted jumpers at home, actually. A given, not stolen.
Sure. We should probably talk about Mission Impossible, if that's okay, if you don't mind. Because
my mint tea whilst you do.
Please. Tom Cruise obviously famously injured himself on the set of Mission Impossible 6.
I love it. Anyone can fall on the street, but Tom Cruise famously injured
himself. It's the most famous injury of the year, if not all time.
Well, funnily enough, he's one of those men, he'll just recover like no one else.
Yeah.
It probably was blown up out of proportion.
Maybe.
But
filming did have to stop a little bit. Did you get a bit of a holiday? Did you just a sudden like
time I did.
Off? Yeah.
I did.
How was that? What did you get up to? Did you just...
Well, I might have gone somewhere and explored.
Okay.
And no, I just decided to have, we had a 10-week hiatus.
Okay.
Which for, on my side of it, becomes vacation. Because my idea was to go on a vacation after the film wraps. So you just have to change it around a bit.
Okay, nice.
And I can imagine for Tom, it means recover whilst producing and writing and working. So everyone else sort of goes on holiday.
Right.
Except him.
Yeah.
But no, I look forward to going into it again.
Yeah.
I miss the team and I miss the training and...
Yeah. So there's still a little bit more shooting to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting.
Mm.
I mean, you're probably sworn to secrecy, but what can you tell us about Ilse Faust in this film? Because obviously the last we saw her, she was sort of driving off into the distance.
Yes, she was. She was driving away and she said, you know how to find me.
Yeah.
And they know how to find her, apparently.
Presumably so, yeah.
Or maybe she knows how to find them.
Okay, interesting.
I mean, that is the best thing about Ilse, isn't it? She kind of just comes and she goes and she does her own thing.
Right.
Which we're trying to maintain in this film as well.
Okay.
The elusiveness of her.
Yeah.
Like, you never really know where you have her.
Yeah.
With some great action sequences. But I mean, Tom is in a helicopter in New Zealand doing incredible stunts.
Yeah.
We were in Paris where we had motorbike chases. And
yeah.
I never really know the arc of the story until I see it.
Okay.
So we kind of shoot episodical bits.
Right, okay. You're only given like
snippets
of
it. And you,
okay.
Yeah, and then you kind of put it together later on, which is an interesting way of filming.
Yeah. Obviously in the last film we saw you rappel off an opera house.
Yes.
Despite your fear of heights, do you have any, you know, phobia crushing stunts this time?
No, not this time around, which is quite lovely. My feet are firmly on the ground.
Okay.
But there are always sort of the momentums of the fighting sequences that are really hard and tough.
Yeah.
And I do want to do all of those moves myself. So I train.
Yeah.
But no, I'm not rappelling off anything yet. Good. Who knows? You know what? They'll probably hear this and go, ha ha.
It's a good idea.
You know what, honey? You are going to rappel off double the height.
Yes. Well, we know Tom Cruise always listens to the Empire podcast. He's a big fan.
You know, he probably does.
Maybe.
You don't know. You are.
With Hugh Jackman.
Yep.
And you play Jenny Lind. Is that right?
The
Swedish opera singer.
Mm.
What can you tell us about that? Are you singing in this
well,
one?
Well, we'll see what they use. Basically, I'm playing one of the world's best singers. What they need is one of the world's best singers to portray this character.
Right.
But what I did for myself is they have this incredible girl singing, Lauren, who I hope they take her voice.
Right.
Because she just needs to sing for me. But I trained with Anna Kirsa, who is the south part of Sweden's best teachers. And I called and I said, when I stand on that stage in front of those 600 extras, I want to sing this song and I want to do it. And then if they want to cut it out and they want to use her voice or intercut and they could mix her voices together, that's fine.
Right.
But for myself, I want to come home and feel like I've done it.
Yeah.
And I did it.
Yeah.
Over and over and over and over until the audience were so bored. and that was an achievement. And if they use my voice, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
They should use hers. But,
well, we'll see.
We'll see. It's just for me knowing that I did it.
Yeah.
It's enough.
You have a background in dancing. This is a big, you know, old school Hollywood musical. Did you get to...
I'm still.
You're still
the
entire time.
My character stands still. I tried to get a little bit of hip action in. Yeah. And Michael and Hugh just went, and still. Just stand still.
You weren't tempted to just sort of...
Just break out in a pas de bourrée and a big twirl. Yes. All the time.
Yeah.
No, but she's very still. She's not a part of the circus.
Right.
So we have P.T. Barnum, who is the creator of this very variety theatre with the oddballs, the tattered woman, the bearded woman.
Right.
But he hasn't really gained the respect from the high society. People just kind of laugh at him. Nothing is really real with what he does.
Yeah.
And he realised that the only way for him actually to gain respect from the people with money is to travel with Jenny Lind, who is utmost quality and best. She's best friends with the Queen of England, basically.
Okay.
So if he presents her and her opera and the way she sings, people will see him in another light.
So you're bringing a bit of class to proceedings.
So I bring a little bit of class and sophistication. So no pas de bourrées.
No pas de bourrées.
No.
Okay. Fair enough.
Which is fun. And then now I'm actually, whilst shooting Mission, I'm doing The Kid Who Would Be King.
Right, with Joe Cornish.
Yes. Do you know Joe?
Yeah, well, not personally.
He's
but I'm
going
a big
to be
fan.
Listening to this.
I hope so.
Yes.
I do hope so.
I mean, I'd see him and Simon because they're pretty good friends.
Yeah.
They'd be listening to this.
Yeah.
and ridiculously excited. I mean, I can't tell you. I'm going to be a wizard dragon by weekend and a spy for Mission during weekdays.
Wow, that's quite a job, isn't it?
Let's not mix them up.
So what is a wizard dragon?
Well, Morgana, basically.
Right,
so she is the stepsister to King Arthur.
Okay.
And she believes she has the utmost
regal rights to the sword Excalibur.
Right. And it's like a, is it like a sort of family comedy?
Yeah. Well, no. It's actually quite intense.
Okay.
It's a young adventure film with you know, I would say goblins and sorcery and darkness and magic and it's going to be incredibly intense.
Wow.
And Patrick Stewart plays Merlin.
Right. Okay. Well, we really look forward to that. I just very quickly wanted to ask about The Lady and the Panda.
Yes.
Because there were reports that you'd signed up to that. I just wanted to know what the status of that
was. What happened?
Yeah.
It was one of those situations where things worked very well up until the moment when it didn't really work out for the production or for me and time-wise.
Okay.
And I think there was issues with transport into the country, and then all of a sudden things shifted and we needed to make a quick decision on how to proceed. And I had to, sadly enough, throw myself into something else.
Right.
And they had to move forward.
Okay.
So sadly, we kind of had to part. And I don't know if they're filming right now.
Right.
I'm trying to not think about the idea that I'm not running in the beautiful mountains with pandas.
In the Himalayas, yeah.
You know what? I'm a dragon.
You're a dragon.
I'm a spy. I'm doing other things.
You're doing okay.
I'm happy.
You're doing okay. Rebecca Ferguson, thank you very much for
your
time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was Rebecca Ferguson. And now this is the news section of the podcast. However, this has been recorded on Friday the 13th of November, the day after the rest of the regular podcast that you're listening to, because we have convened a special news meeting here in the studio. I'm joined not by John Nugent, but by James Dyer. And I don't know if you can hear that, but Helen O'Hara is currently in a train station in Acton. Hello, Helen.
Hello.
Okay, how are you?
I'm good.
Good, good,
good. My way back from exciting places.
Indeed. And then we have Terry White, our editor-in-chief, who is in Scotland. Hello, Terry.
Hello, Chris.
Wow, you sound loud and clear. I didn't think they had reception of the guy in Scotland. That's amazing.
Yes, I speak to you direct from Scotland.
How are they up there? Are they okay?
It's very wet, very rainy, and very Scottish, just as I expected.
All right, great. And the reason that we've convened this special news meeting, and the reason that Terry and Helen have dialed in, is because we want to address this the news story that has blown up this week. I think it's probably the biggest news story that hit Hollywood, certainly the biggest scandal to hit Hollywood in a long, long time. And this is the allegations of sexual abuse and a sexual assault levied at Harvey Weinstein. There has been a snowball that started last week and has rolled and rolled and rolled, and it seems like this thing could blow up. This could be a seismic event for Hollywood. Number of people are coming forward every day with new allegations against Harvey Weinstein. Other people are now being brought into this as well. This feels to me like this could be a bit of a watershed moment for Hollywood. Terry or Helen, whoever wants to talk on that one first.
I mean, I think it could be. I think that what we're seeing is a lot of people who are fed up with the way that things are and the way that things have been historically. And what's been really striking over the last week or so is, first of all, how many women saw it as the cost of being just the cost of doing business until the first few allegations came forward, and who have now come to see that, hang on, this isn't really okay. This isn't really just background sexism. This is, you know, this is a huge problem, and it is right that we should stand up and speak about it.
So I think what we're seeing here really with the Weinstein situation, I mean, it's a systemic issue, and it's clearly something that has been going on for many, 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 many decades. And as Helen said, I think it's extraordinary that we are talking about women who used to be actors, who still are actors. We've got women who are, you know, the biggest A-list actors in the world, with incredible profiles, who are very outspoken on tons and tons and tons of things, who have felt unable to speak until now. And I think that the response from pretty much the majority of Hollywood has been entirely appropriate. I think the way people have come together to kind of really say that this is completely unacceptable, I think there's been probably a little bit of minimising over the years, you know, things like the terms casting couch, which I hate, because that really minimises and normalises what we're talking about. And what we're talking about is everything from harassment to coercion to abuse and to rape and assault, and it covers, or people use it to cover all of those things in terms of how the studio system works, but actually, you know, that term is incredibly outdated, and it, to me, bears no relation to what we're talking about here with Feinstein, and I think it is a huge watershed moment. I think the industry will never be the same again after this, and nor should it be. And I just hope that the women who have spoken out and are finding, I think, solidarity in each other and with each other in terms of finally being able to openly discuss this and what they've been through. And I think that in and of itself means that silence being broken means this kind of systemic nature and of this abuse can no longer continue in the way that it seems to have been doing for decades. Mm.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think there's been a prevalent attitude, and I don't think it's just Hollywood. I think it's also the music industry, and I think it's also the sports industry to an extent as well over the years, that there's been an attitude that you can act with impunity by and large as long as you deliver the goods, whether that's artistically or from a sporting point of view. And I think that attitude is abhorrent, and I think that hopefully, I think you begin to see, as far as I can tell anyway, the music industry begin to get its act together after, you know, certain allegations, well, not certain, certain convictions of people over the last few years. Obviously, TV has had a historical problem as well, and I think that's putting this house in order. And I think Hollywood now needs to take a really, really long, hard look at itself and go, how much were we enabling behaviour? How much were we turning a blind eye to behaviour? And can we put a foot down in the future and say, it doesn't matter how talented you are, if you are acting illegally or immorally, then you cannot work in this town.
The number of women who are actually assaulted at any point in their lifetime is ridiculously high, and this isn't just a Hollywood problem. This is, you know, this is a bigger problem in our society, and women face threats at home, they face threats at work, they face threats in so many different situations. And I think, as you say, when it's something like this situation where there is a definite kind of power structure which enables this kind of thing to go on, then until that starts to get dismantled and really looked at and taken apart, then it's too easy for these things to happen, and also then for there to be a silence about it. And I also think the narrative being challenged in terms of, you know, why didn't women speak up and things like that, I'm really encouraged to see people turning around and actually saying, hang on, no, the onus should be on the person who's committed the crime or not the victim. That is not what the narrative should be. Actually, it's been, you know, for people to be saying, why are we asking women why they didn't speak up? Why are we asking other actors why they didn't speak up? The onus is on the person who is committing the crime not to behave like that. And actually, you know, the fact that as more women have spoken, more women have felt able to, and also more men. We've seen men talking about their own kind of experiences when it comes to this kind of situation. And the fact that they found comfort in solidarity and being able to share their stories and be open. And that's why it's kind of been a bit of a watershed moment, I think, because actually just a number of people of a certain profile feeling confident enough to be able to speak out about it has encouraged other people to. And I think it's also clear that there is a part of male Hollywood that has endured some similar things as well. So I think it's probably a bigger problem than anybody might have fully anticipated originally.
Okay, James, what's your take on the whole situation?
No, I agree entirely. A lot of people have been, I guess, fatigued by the fact that this is now been dominating social media for days in a row, and I think, weirdly, long may it continue. I think the benefit of U-Tree and all of that, unearthed, it woke people up to the dangers of predatory behaviour and something that had been completely normalised over time. And I think this is something that's gone on for decades, and it's not exclusive to Hollywood or entertainment as a whole. This happens in every career, in every country. And I think the more you talk about it, the more you expose the fact that this shouldn't be normalised and that this isn't acceptable behaviour. And weirdly, it is, you know, this is a male thing to talk about as well. Like, you know, people are saying on Twitter, you know, for women, we think about this stuff, we talk about this stuff all the time. I think the problem is men don't think about this stuff and don't necessarily talk about this stuff. And that's something that needs to change as well. So, yes, I think hopefully this will see a sea change in the way this issue is dealt with in Hollywood. But hopefully it will spill over into the world as a whole.
The last word from all three of you, very, very quickly. Where do we go from here? Where does Hollywood go from here?
My feeling on this is we need to go somewhere. And it's this, that it feels that this has got a lot of exposure and people are paying attention to it and people are saying something must be done because so many people have come out of the woodwork. But I think my concern with this isn't the first time this has happened. This isn't the first time this has been reported. And there are a number of filmmakers who've been accused of this sort of thing who continue to get work. There are filmmakers who've been convicted of this kind of thing who continue to work and continue to output because they're seen as contributing artistically to Hollywood. And that is unacceptable. And people should not work with these men. Mm-hmm. They should refuse to be in their films. And that hasn't happened up until now. I'm hoping this will see a tipping point and maybe that will change and they will be held accountable for their actions, however historical.
Indeed. Helen?
I also think there's going to be another wave of allegations after this against other people. Harvey Weinstein may be, as Emma Thompson put it, the sort of top of the ladder of abuse, but that's not to say he's the only one who's committed serious abuses. And I think that there are a lot of very worried men in Hollywood and elsewhere who realise that they have a lot of stuff hiding in their closets that could well come out. So I don't know that this is... I don't think this is going to end with Weinstein, and I think how far it rolls will determine how much of a long-term effect it has.
I agree. I think we'll be talking about this on the podcast for a long time to come. And Terry, a last word from you on this horrible situation.
I mean, quite honestly, my thoughts this time are just with all the women who have come forward and all the women who maybe haven't come forward, and anybody who's kind of experienced this or been a victim of this. And I hope that this actually begins a period of healing for them and enables them to start working through it, because I think that ultimately... It should be the priority right now. And as James says, I think if there's conversations to be had about, you know, how these things get to happen and become normalised, then that hopefully starts now. But I think this is the start of a long process for the industry and for those people involved as well.
Absolutely. And there we have to leave it. Terry, enjoy Scotland. Helen, enjoy the train station. Thank you so much for calling in.
Cheers, bye.
See you around. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, thanks once again to James Dyer for this impromptu news appearance.
You are welcome.
Thanks to Terry and Helen for calling in. Helen wanted to be here, but the train's way later. And Terry was very, very keen to be a part of it as well. So thank you to both of them for calling in. And now we're going to return you to yesterday's pod. It's me and John in the pod booth again. And hey, we're going to be talking about Star Wars, a much lighter and happier subject. Enjoy. Time now for this week's movie news, and this week we saw a new Star Wars trailer for the new Star Wars film, The Last Jedi, and everyone seems to be very, very excited, and I would say with good reason, wouldn't you, John?
Yes, indeed. It's been 6 months since we last saw a trailer for...
6 months?
Yeah, wow. That was when we had the teaser. So obviously the anticipation has been intense on the internet, I would say. And I'd say it delivered. I think it's the perfect kind of trailer, which gives you a real flavour and a taste of the sort of film we can expect without actually giving anything away. I mean, we're 2 months away from release. I still don't really know what is going to happen in this film. I know that Rey will get some sort of Jedi training with Luke, but
yeah.
Beyond that,
yeah, I don't know the story, and I'm not writing anything for this for the magazine, so I'm actually able to divorce myself in a nice way. And you know, my relationship with Star Wars is really weird. I'm a Star Wars kid. I grew up Star Wars. I love Star Wars with every fiber of my being. But while I appreciated the elements of The Force Awakens, it is a movie that diminishes for me with each viewing, and I feel it's a bit of a retread of A New Hope. And I liked Rogue One, but again, it's not a movie that I felt compelled to revisit. And I kind of wondered if I'd lost my Star Wars spark a little bit, whether it maybe just passed me, was beginning to pass me by a little bit. I don't really feel the connection with these characters that I felt with Han and Luke and Leia and Chewie. But this trailer has beginning to rekindle that spark. I think I've only seen it twice, and I don't really want to see it again too many more times. And I'm really glad I don't know anything about the story. But what I got was a succession of lovely images and lovely Star Wars images that felt like Star Wars. And I'm just really excited to see what they do with this movie. I don't know how much of the trailer is going to be a bit of a red herring, in that it seems to be leading you down the path that Luke is in some way going to try to stop the Jedi, or stop the Jedi and the Sith from propagating, I guess, and from rebuilding again. and he might become some sort of weird insurgent of some kind. I don't know if they're going to do that. There's hints that Ray might be conflicted in some way.
Yeah, I think that's misdirection. I think there's a couple of sequences in the trailer which suggest things that I think probably won't come to pass. So I don't think Ray is likely to turn to the dark side.
But that would be interesting.
It would be a bit of a twist, wouldn't it? Yeah.
The interesting thing for me is, would Kylo Ren go the other way, given that he's coming from a much more, you would say, irredeemable place?
That's right, and it's sort of hinted at in The Force Awakens, that sort of pull between good and bad. He's kind of...
It's not subtly hinted at, is
it's
it?
But, yeah.
He literally says it.
Yeah, if you watch closely and listen to the words that he says...
you may find the subtle clues.
Yeah. It also hints in the trailer the potential death of Leia, which, again, I feel... I really hope that that's a fake-out, because I feel a beloved character like that needs a more respectful way to go, considering that Carrie Fisher obviously passed away shortly after filming.
I don't... Yeah, you're right. I think the trailer is set up to do that. I don't think they're going to do that. At least I don't think they're going to do it the way it looks in the trailer. I wouldn't be surprised if Leia is given a lovely... send off. I don't think it's going to be a Paul Walker situation where his character lives on in the Fast and Furious universe and is off raising kids with his wife. I think that the ongoing nature of the story means that Leia's story will have to come to an end.
Yeah.
And it's terrible, but I'm not sure that they're going to do it in the way that they're suggesting in the teaser. I think you're right. I think this is a really interesting teaser. There's lots of ways this movie could go. And correct me if I'm wrong here, John, because I usually do frame by frame breakdowns of trailers, and I haven't done it with this one. So I haven't, like I say, I've only seen it twice. Once on a phone, once on an iPad, as intended by Rian Johnson. There's nobody else at Del Toro, is there, in this trailer?
Not that I could see, no.
Laura Dern?
No, we see her in the first trailer, I think, but not in this one.
That's interesting, especially Benicio Del Toro. I was like, what is his character? Is he Benicio Del Toro-esque, or is he doing a mocap jobby like Andy Serkis?
I think he's himself, because I think we have seen...
I hope he's himself.
Well, yeah. He's not played by another actor. I think he's appearing in live action, because the Vanity Fair shoot, I think Annie Leibovitz shot him in costume. He plays a character called DJ, if memory recalls. He'll be, setting up some raves on Canto Bright.
All right, who's got a red lightsaber? Wave it in the air. Now here's Gavin with the weather.
What?
That's what DJs do. They drop fat beats, and then they go to Gavin with the weather. He's in the Whirlybird high above Worcester.
Yep. We also saw Porgs in the trailer, which the internet is going nuts for. Absolutely nuts. Yeah. He's basically just sort of like tiny chickens crossed with like puffins. Right. Crossed with...
Have the Porgs escaped a Jar Jar-esque backlash? What? Because they seem to me like, or Ewok-esque backlash. It seems to me that people loved Porgs, but those same people, if an Ewok appeared, they'd be going, kill them all.
Yeah, it's funny that. It's funny. I actually spoke to Neil Scanlon today, who is the head of the Creature Workshop for Star Wars.
Wow.
And he told me that when they were designing the Porgs, they very much had the Ewoks in mind, because they exist on this very fine line of you either love them or you hate them.
Yes.
And I think, I don't know, they've obviously, they've done something right, basically, because... pretty much everyone I've seen on Twitter has gone utterly fucking nuts for them.
But we're very, very excited about this. I think Rian Johnson's a fantastic writer and director, and I'm very excited about it. And I'm going to try and keep Radio Silent now in Star Wars until it comes out, and we shall see what we can see. Right, we don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to...
Quick fire,
really, really quickly. So what do you think about this Rock and Tyrese feud that is going on right now? To fill people in on this, so it's been announced recently, it's been rumoured for a while, but it's been announced that the Hobbs and Shaw spin-off will actually happen, and it's going to happen before Fast and Furious 9. So The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, and Jason Statham are going to come together to play Luke Hobbs and Deckard Shaw. who was Ian Shaw when he first appeared in Fast and Furious 6, let's not forget. And it's going to be a spin-off. And this has really pissed off Tyrese Gibson, who took to Instagram earlier on, it was either earlier on this week or last week, and was just not happy about it. He was not happy about it. And he was saying all sorts of, just annoyed things about The Rock.
Just stop it.
How dare you? Well, you want spin-offs? Well, I was offered a Roman and Tej spin-off, and I said no, said Tyrese Gibson.
Definitely telling the truth there.
Really?
Yeah.
Roman and Tej spin-off, eh? Okay. So that's happened, and then The Rock last night posted a video where he was criticizing, shall we say, critiquing mm-hmm. Tyrese's new album, and he called it, and I quote, dog shit. So it seems to me... that there's a little bit of a feud going down.
God, I mean, guys,
my money's on.
They just need to have a barbecue as soon as possible. They need to get some Coronas out. Yeah, they need to find a rooftop.
The Rock.
I know The Rock. Yeah,
good friends.
We need
Rock.
To speak. We need to catch up. Oh, I worry about these guys. It's not going to end well. When you got a candy ass on your tail.
I'm intrigued. I really am. I'm fascinated to see how this thing turns out. But we know already that The Rock and Vin Diesel did not get on the set of Fast 8. So to the extent where they're basically not in the movie together.
Yeah.
And so now I wonder if Fast 9 and Fast 10, if gradually the original cast members of the franchise, from movies 1 to 4, are going to get so annoyed with The Rock that gradually he's just going to be filming the movie on his own.
Yeah, The Rock's going to film all his scenes on green screen and they'll just stitch him in. I saw on his the Rock sort of vaguely addressed this feud on Instagram. He quoted his character Hobbs and he said, "Let's have some fun," and to quote Hobbs the boss, "If you don't like it, we're happy to beat that ass like a Cherokee drum."
Are you sure that was Hobbs? Are you sure that wasn't Shakespeare? all right, okay. So then very, very quickly, there's some other stuff going down as well this week. Sylvester Stallone has been confirmed as the director of Creed 2 or Rocky 8, whatever way you want to look at it, but it will be officially Creed 2, which we think will pit Creed, Adonis Creed, against the son of Dolph Lundgren's Ivan Drago, which is all very, very exciting indeed. I'd love Ryan Coogler to come back and direct that, but he is not available, and I guess nobody knows that franchise better than Sylvester Stallone. Although one of the things I loved about Creed was how Coogler's worldview, the original Rocky is very much told from the viewpoint, it was written by Stallone, who was very much a young Italian-American man growing up in a major city, and Creed was very much about a young African-American man in Philadelphia, and he had all of Coogler's point of view and all his worldview crammed into that film. And going from that to Stallone is going to be an interesting switch, but listen, the man directed Rocky IV and could do no wrong as far as I'm concerned.
That's right. Heart's indeed on fire.
I want a robot in this one.
Maybe they should go to space.
They should go to space.
That's what this franchise needs.
I will break you in space.
The space race. We should quickly talk maybe about the Settlers of Catan game,
which
is being made into a film. I think we should.
Okay.
Well, let's just mention it. It's being made into a film. It's really exciting. I'm a huge fan of the board game. I regularly build up a wall-based empire when playing that game, so I'm intrigued to see how they will turn a board game based on island trading into an exciting film, but we'll see.
I'm glad we took the time to talk about this because that is compelling content.
Isn't it?
It really is.
Isn't it just?
That was good stuff. Jackie Chan confirms Rush Hour 4 is happening. No, Jackie. Back away from the script for Rush Hour 4. Don't do it to yourself, man. Honestly. Right, so we have another guest.
Yes, please. Yes.
So Noah Baumbach is a director, writer-director, actually, of wonderful movies like Frances Ha and The Squid and the Whale and Margot at the Wedding. His latest movie debuts on Netflix today, I think. And it is a cracking film called The Meyerowitz Story, brackets new and selected, great cast, Adam Sandler, Ben Stiller, Dustin Hoffman, Elizabeth Marvel. So Noah Baumbach has made a Marvel movie, everybody. I knew he would. It was only a matter of time. And Emma Thompson as well stars in this, and it's about a New York family. The father, Dustin Hoffman, is a temperamental artist, and his sons are Adam Sandler and Ben Stiller, and his daughter is Elizabeth Marvel, and it is a series of vignettes in their life. And Bamback was in this week for the LFF Laugh Gala of the Meyerowitz Stories New and Selected that was presented by Empire, and yes, hosted by yours truly. And before we did that, I went along and spoke to him in a lovely, ravishing London hotel room. So here are some New and Selected highlights from that chat. Enjoy.
Noah, I have to clear something up before we start properly. I am wearing a De Palma t-shirt. This was completely unintentional. It was on top of my drawer when I picked it up this morning. But are you a man who wears director t-shirts? Do you have you worn this t-shirt before, this De Palma t-shirt?
Well, I made a movie about
Absolutely.
Him.
Yep.
And we're very friendly, and we have sort of a group of us directors who in New York who often we have like sort of a standing dinner every week.
Okay.
And Brian is one of them. And yes, one of the dinners actually I bought from the IFC Center, which is,
okay.
Was nearby. They sell these De Palma. Yeah. And I guess you should explain, it looks like the Def Leppard.
Yes.
But yeah, so I have a photo actually that maybe after this I can try to find on my phone for you of Brian De Palma with the Brian De Palma t-shirt.
And oh wow, okay, excellent. And if there was one for you, because this is a series of t-shirts that takes directors' names and stylizes them in the style of famous rock bands.
Right.
So there's a Lars von Trier in the style of Van Halen. So if someone were to do you, which band would you want? I mean, the Beatles immediately suggest itself.
Well, I guess you got to go by font, right? You know, it's like nice to have the... I'm trying to... Yeah, I guess with Baumbach, you have Beatles, you have... we could do Beastie Boys.
Beastie Boys would be interesting.
That might be, yeah.
We'll see if this can, we can make
Bronsky
this work.
Beat. Whatever we have.
Okay. Well, let's see. Next time we talk for your next movie, maybe we'll have this t-shirt made up.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what the font is for Bronsky.
Yeah, I'm not even sure they have a font, but we will look into it and make it work.
Everybody's got a font, right?
Everyone's got a font, precisely. Congratulations on the film, the Meyerowitz Stories. Brackets New and Selected, which fascinates me because obviously as a writer, you sit down, you plot out a movie, you plot out characters. The selected part is intriguing to me. Does that indicate that there are other stories that were on the, not just the cutting room floor, but the writing room floor?
Well, it's there to indicate that there could have been, or mm-hmm. that it is part of a bigger group of stories, as you said. I mean, I think that was, when I was writing it, it was it helped for some reason for me to think of it as like some author had written about this family over the course of his career and published various stories, and at some mm-hmm. point they were anthologized and put together, and you know, not all of them were included, some were, you know, and that he wrote maybe a couple extra new ones for the volume, and yeah. And that was useful for me in some way, I think, to when I was writing, to figure out the structure, which is broken mm-hmm. into yes. these sort of sections or almost like short stories. But I didn't actually go write those other stories. This is just,
okay. Okay.
I just did exactly what I needed to do and then left the rest to your imagination.
Okay. So as you were finished the script, there was nothing extraneous.
Well, no, of course there always is. But the challenge from, you know, me in writing it, I mean, I was just writing a lot of stuff and a lot of it was junk and not really clicking. But I think that the structure, when I figured out the structure of the movie, that was very useful for me because then I could, I don't know, it somehow unlocked stuff for me, and it also helped even me figure out the characters and figure out the so I kept it. I kept it as the title. It's not really, you know, like you say, I don't know that you need to, you know, think of it as a collection of stories when you watch the movie, but you know, it meant something to me.
No, I love it. It's fantastic. And was that the starting point, in a way? Was the starting point the idea of telling something in this sort of short story format, this sort of chapter format? That
came later. I mean, I knew I was writing about adult siblings, and I wanted to write about how they were kind of contending with their father. It was something I had tried actually years ago before I wrote what became The Squid and the Whale. Mm-hmm. I actually started that from the perspective of adult siblings.
Okay.
And I think I sort of probably reached a point where I thought, like, well, do I write a flashback? Do I write something that didn't seem right for that movie, but seemed somehow more where my heart was at the time. And, okay. and I think yeah. it was for me then writing from the kid's perspective is sort of what opened up that mm-hmm. story in that movie. And so it, you know, I guess, you know, it was still with me, and I, you know, with some more perspective and some miles on me, I was able to come back to it.
Do you start with characters, and do you start with a specific character?
It depends on every movie's different. I used to be much more, I don't know if I was going to say pure. I don't know if this is a purer way or not, but I would start with character and let the character kind of almost dictate what the story became. Like, the more I wrote the character, the more the story would reveal itself. That was mm-hmm. true, very much true, with Greenberg and Margot at the wedding and Squid to some degree too, mm-hmm. although I think I knew more of what that story was going to be. I knew it was going to be about a divorce. But I've gotten more, maybe starting around Frances Ha, I've gotten much more, I've gotten looser, I guess. I'm just less, more open to whatever this one's going to be. And I've also find that structure often helps, as I was saying, even about the Meyerowitz, is that the structure in a way helps unlock
the
characters. So, you know, with Frances, it was, you know, we had lots of, Greta and I wrote it together. We had lots of, notes and ideas and things, but it was really the structure of creating sort of chapters of different locations that she was kind of, without a home, without roots, and breaking it up that way kind of, I think, also helped us understand who okay. Frances herself was.
Yeah. And so it's fascinating that you say that this movie, I mean, not directly, but you had this, you were exploring territory like this a few years ago. Does that mean that if we opened your desk drawer, there would be lots of unused screenplays, unfinished screenplays? Are you that
no,
sort of writer?
No, there wouldn't be, actually. There's lots of unused bits and scenes and mm-hmm. ideas and but there isn't any, you know, certainly not in the last, I don't know, maybe 15 years or something, there isn't any like screenplay that I wrote that I didn't do anything with. I mean, mm-hmm. I usually have one idea or thing in reserve kind of floating in my head that isn't quite ripe or isn't quite ready.
Okay. Yeah.
And that sort of hangs back while I work on the thing I'm working on. And then when I finish the thing I'm working on, that thing kind of finds its way to the forefront. But,
oh, okay.
but I don't, that could be a tiny thing, like you know, somebody wears a green jacket, you know, on, you know, and you know, it's you know, like with Meyerowitz, in a way, the thing I knew I wanted to include was scenes in a hospital. This is now before I knew the family, I knew okay. exactly how it was going to go down.
Yeah.
Because it was something that I'd wanted to try to find a way to do in a movie was recreate in some way, you know, what had been my experience of being in a hospital, which I found I hadn't quite seen in a movie before.
Yes. Yes. And I don't want to delve too much into that in case people label it as a spoiler, but you have an amazing cast in this movie. And, you know, we know that Dustin Hoffman could be great. We know Emma Thompson could be great in a dramatic role. And I believe you worked with Ben Stiller once or twice as well.
Yes.
So we know what you can get from him. I'm a big Adam Sandler fan, and he is fantastic in this movie. Are you a big Adam Sandler fan? Do you
sit
at home and watch Happy Gilmore? Is that is that the sort of thing you
for sure?
So, where did you first see him and then think?
Well, I guess I first saw him on Saturday Night Live, you know.
Yeah.
And then I've been, you know, like everybody else, you know, going to his movies. Adam had reached out to me, I don't know, a few years ago, and just said, you know, if you ever have something, you know, I'd hope you'd think about me. And, and, you know, as I've, in my experience, you know, I've had actors do this, and then, you know, you send them a script, you know, a year or so later, and they say like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't respond to the part. And you're thinking, come on, you know? I thought you asked me. But Adam was true to his word, and I actually spoke with Adam and Ben, and we got together before I wrote the script. We kind of talked about like what would that be. You know, we just had a kind of wide ranging conversation about, you know, sort of about family, about, you know, that was, we had sort of just the vague idea that they might be brothers, and then after the lunch we basically had this sort of vague idea that they should get into a physical fight at some point. And that's about all I had when I went to write the script.
Brilliant. Noah Bronski Beat. Noah Baumbach.
Yeah, Bronski Beat. Let's Google some album covers.
Yeah, I'll try and get this t-shirt for you the next time we speak. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.
So that was Noah Baumbach, then director of the Meyerowitz Stories, Brackets, New and Selected. Obviously very important, the New and Selected part. Mm. So let's start the reviews section of the show by talking about that film. John, you haven't seen this?
I haven't seen this, no.
You haven't seen this. It is on Netflix as of this weekend. I think maybe next weekend. You'll know it anyway when you finish watching The Good Place, because I assume you're watching The Good Place, right?
I haven't seen this. No, I want to see this. Yeah, everyone's saying it's great.
I should have talked more about The Good Place this week. I feel like I haven't mentioned it once, and it's absolutely amazing.
More like Great Place.
The Great Place, the very great place. I will talk about the Meyerowitz Stories in a second, but if you haven't been watching The Good Place, it is a cracking sitcom. It's more than a sitcom, actually. That is, it was on NBC last year in the States. Its second season is just beginning in the States. It's about 4 or 5 episodes in, I think, now. And its first season, 13 episodes, has hit Netflix in its entirety. And now they're following the Better Call Saul route as well, and that will be getting new episodes weekly. I guess Star Trek Discovery is doing that as well. It is fantastic. Stars Kristen Bell. Feels like we're sponsored by the Good Place, but we're not. Stars Kristen Bell as a lady called Eleanor who dies and goes to heaven, and that is the Good Place. And it is a neighborhood that is governed by an architect, Michael, played by Ted Danson, who's wonderful, playing very much an under Ted Danson-y type figure. And there she is. She teams up with a number of people, including her soulmate. That's what we're told. Her soulmate, Chidi, who's played by William Jackson Harper, and Jamila Jamil from T4. Remember Jamila from T4?
Yeah, I do.
She's in the show. She's like third billed. She's like one of the main cast members, and she's really, really great. She's playing like a British socialite called Tahani. Who's quite snooty and quite uppity, but we obviously get to know more about her as the show goes on, and she's fantastic as well. And it's a really, really well written show. Very, very surprising. It is very philosophical as well. It's from Michael Schur, who is behind the likes of Parks and Recreation and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And this may be, it's only one season, 1.5 seasons in, this may be his crowning glory. Wow. In that it's an episodic show. And that, you know, it's perfect for Netflix actually, because each episode ends with a cliffhanger, and which is very unsitcom like. But you really just want to watch the next episode instantly. And I'm about to get to that point where I won't have another episode to watch, and I don't know what I'm going to do after that. I'm going to have to watch The Mayor with Stories New and Selected. There
hey,
we go.
Segway.
We're back in the room.
Segway.
Oh, give us your rewards. The Merit Stories, New and Selected. Yes, so this is Noah Baumbach's new latest movie. I like this movie a lot. Nothing to do with the fact that I was hosting the LFF Laugh Gala. I promise you, my integrity remains absolutely 100%. Yeah, this is very, very good. It stars wonderful, wonderful cast. Adam Sandler plays Danny, who is he's the eldest son. The eldest son of the Meyerowitz family. His dad, played by Dustin Hoffman, is an artist who is successful, but not as successful as he likes to think he could have been, and is maybe a little bit grumpy about that, a little bit dismissive of others, and certainly the sort of person who will quickly kick his children for not being as successful, and certainly not being as artistic as he was. Also, family is Elizabeth Marvel as Jean, the sister of the family, a bit of an oddball by her own admission, a bit weird, again, a character who is revealed as the movie goes on. And then it's Ben Stiller as, I guess, the most successful on paper of the family. He has become a business manager out in LA, and he comes back to New York to visit the family, and things spiral out from there. And this is a series of vignettes in the life of the family as things happen to them, as you've heard from the interview with Noah Baumbach, as hospital comes into the picture as well, and people start to confront their own mortality and their own ideas of success and failure in life. And this is a very, very well-written movie. It is not one of the Adam Sandler Netflix movies. It is not The Ridiculous Six or The Do-Over or I don't know what else he's got coming out really in terms of his Netflix contract. It just happens to be an Adam Sandler movie that is on Netflix. But it is Adam Sandler very much in the form of Punch Drunk Love or Rain Over Me or those movies where he tends to be maybe a little bit more serious. Was it Men, Women and Children? There's a Jason Reitman movie that he did a few years ago that wasn't very, very good, but he was good in it. And I like Adam Sandler a lot. I think he has real potential. He's got real potential of a man who's in his 40s or maybe even early 50s. But, you know, he gets obviously a bad rap for doing all these terrible, terrible comedies, and clearly he chooses to do them, and he's very, very happy doing them, and he's very well paid doing them, and I think a lot of his friends get work that way, and he's quite happy with that and quite a loyal guy, and that's all good, that's all well and good. And I love Happy Gilmore, and I love You Don't Mess with the Sohan, and I, you know, there are some films, I even like Little Nicky and That's My Boy. I like the dumb Adam Sandler comedies, but there's some truly, truly terrible ones. But he's also a very talented dramatic actor as well. Yeah. And this movie is, I think, a real showcase for that. And this is a dramedy. It is a comedy drama. It is ostensibly a comedy, and then there are dramatic elements that seep in later on. And it is an ensemble piece, and everyone in this is really, really good. I've been reading reports about this in the States about how, you know, if they are going to push this towards for Oscars, if they are going to start doing that sort of thing, how Dustin Hoffman is going to be the person is going to be pushed to the forefront for a Best Supporting Actor nod as the father, Harold. And I can see that. And he's very, very good. And it's a really interesting role because he's quite this, you know, this quite persnickety old man, very, very crusty, who really doesn't have a filter and just says what he likes and just rides roughshod over his kids and their emotions. And it's a great role, and it's a very, very showy role. But for me, the best performance in this movie belongs to Adam Sandler. And he is really, really great as a guy who knows that he could have achieved more in life. Chose not to for a very good reason. He decided to become a house husband and a father to his daughter. And he's just really, really good in this film. And it is a film that is beautifully written and is a succession of wonderful lines. And it's a film that I've been thinking about a lot this week. And it's a film that I think I'm going to come back to again and again. It's one of those movies that I'm going to watch just as a comfort film. It's really, really well written and directed, and good performances throughout.
Wow. Yeah. So do we think Oscar for Adam Sandler? Is that too strong?
No, Hollywood hasn't lost his mind. I mean, there's, but Hollywood does love a narrative, right?
Yeah.
It does love a narrative.
Comeback kids.
So Adam Sandler, but I don't know if it's an Oscar role. Mm. I don't know if it's that Oscar clip role.
Right.
I think Ben Stiller gets an Oscar clip role in this movie. There's the two of them, they're brothers, they're half brothers. They don't really get on. There's quite an antagonistic relationship between them, very frosty. And they begin to break down those barriers. And, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but there is this confrontation between them in the film, which is very funny, but it obviously has dramatic impact as well. And then after that, there's a really great bit of acting from Stiller, you know, where there's a bit of a breakdown scene. Sandler doesn't really get that. And what it does is it's a role that as well, and in the same way that Paul Thomas Anderson did with Punch Drunk Love, it's an Adam Sandler dramatic role that very much plays into the Adam Sandler persona that we know and some people love, which is that very angry, repressed man-child who has just this great well, this knot of anger building inside him, and occasionally it just comes out and, you know, sorry about that, everybody. And he's really, really good in it, but I don't know if it's flashy. Like Robert Redford a few years ago for that great Chasey Chandor film, his name I've completely forgotten.
All Is Lost,
thank you. You know, my whole review about that was if Robert Redford is going to be nominated for an Oscar here, they're going to be hard-pressed finding a clip to play at the Oscars because it is literally 90 minutes of an old man saying nothing.
Just looking slightly dismayed.
And rooting through his stuff to find a tin of beans. Yeah. And that's pretty much as dramatic as it got for him in that movie, even when he was facing perilous life and death situations. It's the same with Sandler in this. But this is a really, really good film. We gave it 4 stars. The Meredith Stories, new and selected. And I will shut up now and let you, John, talk about... what else? What else is happening this week? The Snowman. Should we talk about the Snowman?
Yeah. So this is not, I repeat, not a remake of the classic Christmas time holiday animation. There is no Alan Jones in this Snowman. This is a very much adults-only Snowman. So as we mentioned earlier, this is the adaptation of the, is it Yo Nesbo? Is that how you say his name?
I've heard Joe.
Yo Nesbo. However you say it. Joe Nesbo. This is based on his book, one of a series of books around the detective Harry. In the original Norwegian books, it's Harry Hole, I believe. In this film, it's pronounced Harry Hole. It's spelt Hole. Mm-hmm. There's this whole series of detective books around this character, and this is the first one to make it to screen. So Michael Fassbender plays Harry Hole. He is basically a brilliant detective with the Oslo police force who is also, he also has a terrible drinking problem. He has family issues.
Yes.
But brilliant, so brilliant.
Is he a deep hole? Or is he quite a shallow hole?
He's something of a square hole in a round peg. I don't know.
Okay. And but we should point out this is actually set in Norway.
This is absolutely set in Oslo. Yeah. It's a curious film because it is it's in English. It's all the dialogue is in English. Mm-hmm. So you have this in a similar vein to Fincher's Go with a Dragon Tattoo. You have this array of accents. Fassbender basically goes English. His co-star is Rebecca Ferguson, who plays Katrine Bratt, fellow detective. Mm. And then you get a little bit. So J.K. Simmons is in this film, and he attempts, I guess it's like a light Swedish chef, you know. he really tries a Scandinavian accent.
And what about Val Kilmer? I know Val Kilmer's in this.
Val Kilmer is in this. Is he birdie, or is he? No, he... Well, so it's a strange... We haven't got to the plot yet, but Val Kilmer is a very odd presence in this film. I should probably preface this by saying, so he was reported to have oral cancer.
Yes.
Apparently his tongue was very swollen, and I think it was still swollen at the time of this film.
Oh, really?
All of his dialogue has been dubbed by a different actor.
No, really?
This is what I've read. Allegedly, it's been overdubbed, but it's not been dubbed well. And it gives a very strange... His whole performance is quite unsettling.
Okay.
And I've seen someone describe him as sort of Tommy Wiseau level.
That's harsh on old Val. Come on. Yeah. It's Nick Rivers, for God's sake. Leave him alone.
It's just he's a bizarre presence, put it that way. Okay. In fact, a lot of this film does feel a little bit odd, a little bit off kilter, a little bit like it doesn't fit. So this is directed by Thomas Alfredson, who the Swedish director who did Let the Right One In and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and both of those are really interesting takes on genre. Slow build, and they sort of studiously avoid cliches. And
as you just didn't.
As I just didn't.
As I never do.
As we studiously do not at Empire. And what's interesting about The Snowman is that he doesn't avoid cliches. He seems to actively embrace them. It's very strange.
Okay.
So, you know, Fassbender's character is essentially a walking cliche. I mean, he's a tough cop with a drinking problem. There's one scene where Rebecca Ferguson's character is like, I studied your cases down at the academy. You know, she doesn't say it in an American accent, but you could.
What was that?
That was an approximation.
It started Scottish. You actually went, I studied your cases down at the academy. Did you overdub Val Kilmer?
We're not reviewing me here. We're reviewing the film. Look, it's a very generic film, and it's very strange that someone who made something like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which is so restrained
and frosty, it's a very frosty
very
film.
Frosty, could suddenly make something that just feels like any other detective film.
I've just realised we haven't actually talked about the plot. So what actually happens?
So
that's my fault entirely. I've derailed this
in a very
time.
General sense. There is a serial killer in Oslo, and his calling card is a snowman, so he will kill a person, usually a woman, and then he will leave a snowman outside their house. This leads to some unintentionally hilarious moments where the camera zooms in on a snowman with scary strings music in the background, and we're supposed to be terrified of what is essentially a collection of frozen water with a couple of sticks in the side. That is just particularly rubbish. And the music in general, I think, is not great. It's very prescriptive and, you know, obvious. And, you know, it sends you down quite obvious places. The whole thing really is just quite obvious. It's a real disappointment because, you know, it has got a great cast. It has got a great director from previous form. And, you know, there are so many bits that feel like they don't belong. There's stuff that goes unresolved. There's things that feel like they came from the book and then they never quite had time in the running time to sort of finish it all off. The killer, you can kind of guess about an hour before you actually reveal it. So that loses some of the tension. Fassbender is supposed to be this brilliant cop and he's actually not. He's kind of rubbish. There are a couple of points where you know, it's right in front of him and he just doesn't know what he's doing.
So is this like, obviously they want to start a franchise with this because there's loads of Harry Hole Lay books.
That's right.
But it doesn't sound like we're going to get one.
I think it's very unlikely this will get a second film. And if they do, they'd have to do something very differently. But look, it just doesn't come together for numerous reasons. With the best will in the world, it's just not good. And, you know, maybe it could have done with We're Walking in the Air. Maybe that would have turned things around.
Give it a few months and some YouTube wag will do that. It's all good. All right, so say no man to The Snowman. Just 2 stars for that.
Sadly,
then.
Yes.
So, John, we've got 2 more films. Mm-hmm. But we should say The Loving Vincent, which I have not seen, but people are going nuts about this and it's 4 stars and...
Yes.
It's a documentary.
Yeah, we should mention that just because it is unlike any film I or probably anyone else has ever seen, it's a fairly extraordinary project. So for those who don't know, it is a feature-length film and it's animated and it's entirely animated by oil painting. So it's the world's... they're selling it as the world's first fully painted feature film. They had over 100 artists working on this for several years. 65,000 individual frames were painted. 6 years it took overall. So if you think every single frame on screen is a hand-painted oil painting, I mean, you know, there is a sort of cliche in reviewing that every frame could be a painting, but in this film, every frame literally is a painting.
Wow.
The effect it has is extraordinary. extraordinary. I mean, yeah. It is visually flabbergasting. You know, there was no point when I was watching it thinking, I never forgot what was going on. I was always stunned at how the painting moved. And it's painted in Van Gogh's style as well. So it's this very impressionistic style with very thick paintbrushes. You can see the, you know, the lines of the paintbrush in every frame. And this is, you know, it really, it reminds you of the form, I suppose, and it reminds you of the art, and it reminds you of the sort of artist that Van Gogh was.
Amazing.
So that in itself is makes it just worth the ticket price alone. It really is extraordinary.
I remember Phil just banging on about that before he left, and just how great it was, and to seek it out, and I just haven't been able to get to a screening. So. Yeah. That sounds great.
I think it is just a limited release this weekend.
So. There's an event. There was release, isn't there?
I think there was an event at the National Gallery or something like that.
So it's fantastic. So, but look out for it in DVD and whatnot. So that's Loving Vincent, and I tricked you into talking about it.
Very, very
and
nice.
That's all the time we have. Now let's talk about Lego Ninjago.
Yeah.
4 stars then for Loving Vincent, then we get the Lego Ninjago movie.
Yeah, okay. So let's talk about the Lego Ninjago movie then. And it is Ninjago, not Ninjago. As I learned from watching this film, I'd never heard of Ninjago.
Yes, Ninjago.
Until I'd seen this film, and I suspect many people won't have either. But it is a very popular line of the Lego toys. Mm. It's basically a sort of, you know, ninja Lego. That's what it is. It's sort of vaguely Japanese-inspired brand of the toys. And it is very popular among the Lego faithful. So it's set in the animated Lego world. We've had the Lego movie, we've had the Lego Batman. Mm-hmm. This is set within that same universe, roughly speaking, although we don't see any of the characters from the previous films. Mm-hmm. This is sort of separate, I suppose. And Ninjago is a place. It's a sort of magical place, a sort of vaguely Western crossed with Eastern city. So mm-hmm. you see sort of Japanese characters, but they all speak and sound like Americans.
Okay.
Within this town of Ninjago, there is the secret ninja force, which is a sort of Power Rangers-like set of ninjas, 6 teenage ninjas who each have their own special power and elemental force. And they protect the city of Ninjago from Lord Garmadon, voiced by Justin Theroux in a really, really brilliant way, who is, I must say, quite similar to Lord Business from the first Lego movie, who's voiced by Will Ferrell. Uh-huh. He is just, you know, a cackling baddie with a few wisecracks to spare.
Are they running out of ideas already? Is that what you're saying?
That's maybe what I'm alluding to.
Okay.
Yeah, so the basic idea is the secret ninja force unleashed the ultimate weapon. I'm not going to say what it is, but I will say it involves a live-action element. And then the secret ninja force have to embark on a quest alongside Lord Garmadon to find the ultimate weapon.
Wow. Sounds
yeah.
good.
Yeah. It's like the other Lego movies, it's very fun, it's very fast, it's very energetic. It's maybe almost too energetic in some places. I mean, some of the animation is... I felt a bit sick after a little while.
You know, had that with the first one.
Yeah, it moves so quickly and so bright and so sort of induces motion sickness. But it is very funny. I feel like they are starting to repeat themselves a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
There is that sort of fun irony that is sort of the common theme of these films, which makes it keeps it fairly fresh. But, you know, it's following a very generic template and they're learning very obvious lessons.
And because this is very much focused on Ninjago, it doesn't have that freewheeling universe, I guess, that the Lego movie has.
That's right.
You could have cameos from superheroes and Star Wars characters and Gandalf. And
there's none of that. There are no sort of other properties invading this world. It is just Ninjago. So if you're not familiar with it, I'm sure Ninjago fans will be thrilled. But, mm-hmm. you know, those of us who aren't familiar with it, that it doesn't have as much excitement. Jackie Chan does cameo as a sort of ninja master in live action. The bookends the film, which is quite a nice touch.
All right.
But yeah, it doesn't have quite the same sort of charm as the other films. You know, it's fun, it's disposable, it'll keep the kids happy. But I felt like the Lego movie was something so different and so fresh and so unique. And this I feel is not that.
So should people Ninjago to Lego Ninjago, or should they not?
I think
Jago.
Well, I gave this 3 stars, which, as we do say, is a recommendation. So I think they should Lego.
All right,
they should we should go of their money.
We should Lego as well. We should go. So 3 stars then for the Lego Ninjago movie. I guess that leaves then the Meyerowitz Stories, New and Selected, and Loving Vincent as the films to go and see this week, which is all very, very well and good. That is it.
Yeah.
For this week's edition of the Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by, I'm not kidding you, it's a triple whammy. It is a triple whammy, and I don't know how we're going to do this. This is madness. Daniel Radcliffe. On the podcast to talk about Jungle.
The Boy Wizard.
The Boy Wizard himself. He's grown up. He's all grown up now. Jerry Butler.
Whoa.
Is going to be on the podcast, we hope, to talk about Geostorm.
Whoa.
And if you know anything about the Dissembling, you know he's very excited to be part of that interview. It's going to be happening
it's
next week.
It's going to be a Jerry Storm.
It's going to be huge. And then we'll also be joined by Vince Vaughn.
Whoa.
And S. Craig Soller to talk about the extraordinarily brutal brawl in Cell Block 99, all of which are out next week.
Wow.
So that's a triple whammy.
What
right
a sofa.
There. What a sofa. And also, you should keep your ears peeled as well for a Red Dwarf special as well. So Series 12 started this week on Dave. I still cannot believe there's a TV channel called Dave. But there you go. Red Dwarf Series 12 started this week on Dave. And so we had pretty much the entire cast come in yesterday. Here we had Craig Charles, Robert Llewellyn, Danny John-Jules. We had the co-creator Doug Naylor. Only Chris Barry, I think, couldn't make it. That's very, very exciting. There was a lot of fun. Apparently, I wasn't there. We're going to be doing a special as well with some of the team talking about our memories and our love of Red Dwarf over the years as well. So keep your ears peeled for that. That'll hopefully be next week, or if not, it'll be the week after that. Right. Okay. That's it. Until next time, it is goodbye. From John.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to recruit more people because this is two handers in a row on the podcast.
That's right.
And we frankly need more people. We need a new news editor for one thing. We need to get that person in here and start getting them to do podcasts. So that's what I'm going to do. See you next week.